helpless are we.
Welcome back to Eco Talk, and it is my great pleasure to have with me in the studio Dr. Helen Caldicott, author of about 5 books, including one I'm reading now, an autobiography called A Desperate Passion. In case you've been living under a rock since, the late 70s, Dr. Caldicott, of course, is the lifelong anti-nuclear activist. She's a medical doctor, someone named by the Smithsonian Institution as one of the 20th century's most influential women, and a person also nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Linus Pauling. And she's in the Bay Area to promote a movie, a documentary about your life, and I snagged you because you are one of my inspirations.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
What's that movie about?
Well, someone said it's actually about my niece. My niece, Anna Bronowski, who's in her mid-30s, came to me and said, can I make a film about your life? Because she's always admired me. But she said she couldn't sell it just as a hagiography. It had to be skeptical niece, questions, aunt, running around the world trying to get rid of nuclear weapons. And that's what it became. So it's a very personal film. It makes me somewhat uncomfortable. But it does get to the younger generation because they have a similar skeptical, cynical approach to who do you think you are trying to save the world. But it comes through at the end with my passion, and in the end Anna's convinced. So it's not a pretend film, it's really pretty raw.
And what is your personal story behind the passion, if you can just go back for a minute?
Oh, well,
and tell us what your awakening was.
Yeah. My awakening was reading On the Beach by Neville Shute when I lived in Melbourne, Australia, when I was about 14. And it was about a nuclear war that occurred by accident, and everyone was killed except people in Melbourne because we were so far south. And then gradually the radiation came down and killed us. And at the end of the book, the beautiful, elegant streets of Melbourne are still there with bits of paper blowing down in the breeze and a blind gently flapping, and that's the end of life on Earth. And that marked my soul. I lost my innocence. I was never the same again. And then I entered medical school at 17. And we had a wonderful genetics lecturer, and he taught us about radiation and genetics and how it causes genetic abnormalities and cancer. And at that time, 1956, Russia, America and China were going hell for leather testing bombs in the atmosphere. And Linus Pauling and others said that children would get cancer and leukemia as a result of this. And I could not for the life of me, as a 17-year-old medical student, understand what on earth these characters thought they were doing. And I guess, you know, it's just been accumulation of events that have led me to the point I'm at today.
And wasn't there a key passage in that book about could this have been avoided?
There was, but I can't remember that. But yes,
something about if there wasn't so much silliness and the newspapers had covered what was happening.
Well, yes, and it's happening today. I mean, most people are like sheep. We're like tribes. We go along with the leaders. Well, who are the leaders? You know, they're self-appointed in this country, and they're very, very dangerous. And it's funny how we go along like sheep needing mummies and daddies without realizing that in a democracy or any country, in fact, we are the leaders. And it invokes a lot of energy and discomfort to become a leader, but you have to become one if you're a parent or a grandparent, or even if you're not, if you love the earth, you know, and love the roses and the wisteria. And passivity is suicidal, and we're about to blow ourselves up without any doubt if we don't all get motivated again like we did in the 80s. So it's quite possible we can fix this, as you just pointed out.
There is a resurgence, I think, in environmental interest as well. Interesting that things, you know, were peaking around the 80s and then kind of, you know, ebbed. And when I started doing environmental reporting about 8 years ago, people said, this is a kind of a strange time, Betsy, to be doing this. I said, did we solve the problems? You know, it's like, didn't we hear about this already? But there is an interest, and maybe that's because of what's going on, at least in this country politically, with a sense that our leadership is not leading us down the rose path, but instead the path to ruin.
No, leading us down the garden path.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny what you just said. We've heard it before, and therefore there's no danger. And I'm always reminded of a young man, Danish man, who went to talk to a group of elderly Jews in Denmark to warn them of what Hitler was doing. And they were very bored, and they said, we've heard that before. And he repeated it with a passion, and they said, yeah, we've heard it before, as if that negates the reality. And he burst into tears, and then they got it. And they fled and saved their lives. So hearing it before doesn't negate the honesty and the truthfulness of what we're facing now.
Were you always this courageous and outspoken, or did that build over the years?
No. Well, I guess when I was 30 and my mother had died and I became extremely depressed and I nearly died from hepatitis, which I caught from a patient, and my marriage wasn't too good, I read a book called The Female Eunuch by Germaine Greer, and that changed my life.
Changed my mother's life, too.
And, you know, I thought, my God, can I say that, be that, do that? And I thought, I bloody well will. And it did. I became absolutely certain, with a white-hot certainty, that what I knew was the truth, and nothing's ever stopped me since then. So, yes, and my parents were very authoritarian and dictatorial, so it was only after they died that I rebelled, and I rebelled against the most powerful people in the world, who were the leaders. And it was lucky that my particular neurosis led in the right direction and not the wrong direction.
I'm glad to hear you say it's the right direction, because I know there's been some personal cost to you at taking this kind of stance, trying to wake up the world to something that you believe strongly is so such a clear and present danger. Before we get into that, we're going to have to take a break in just a couple of minutes. And when we return from the break, I'd like to talk about a conference you just recently came from. We'd like to be very timely here on EcoTalk. So we're going to, now that we've looked back, get up to the current time and then talk about what is at stake, what we can do about it, because I'm going to warn you, this is a bit of a depressing hour. Most places air us at early Sunday morning, but I promise we'll end with a call to action. It's a part wake-up call, part call to action. That's
what
EcoTalk is.
Well, it's good to know the truth and act on it, and then you don't need your antidepressants anymore, because you subliminally know the truth, but you take antidepressants if you don't act on it.
Remember, we'll get back to that too. You're listening to EcoTalk on Air America Radio. We'll be right back with Dr. Helen Caldicott.
We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years, when we will have about 10 billion neighbors on this sphere. Will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining?
Welcome back to EcoTalk, and we have Dr. Helen Caldicott in the studio, and talk about a nightmare beyond imagining. Had the, I don't know if I can say pleasure of hearing you speak last night, because it was a real, I mean, I thought I dealt with depressing things, trying to wake people up to climate change and toxins in our bodies and what we're doing to the oceans and ecosystems. Well, what you're trying to rally the masses, the slumbering masses about, is something that could wipe it out even faster than all that.
Oh, sure.
So what made you take this on? Because I sometimes wonder what made me take this on. I mean, a lot of us are taking it on, but you're really almost a one-woman show in terms of your, you know, consistency and how long you've been on this.
Well, I don't know. I can see things very clearly, Connie, and I just act on it. And
yeah, and you see things clearly, which is a blessing and a curse, right?
Yeah, it is. But no, it's not a curse. I just speak the truth, and I'm an Australian, so we shoot straight from the shoulder. People say I'm courageous. I'm not courageous. I just tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may, so I never feel brave.
But people don't necessarily want to hear the truth, do they?
Yes, they do. I find they always do, but you have to approach them in a certain way. It's like approaching a patient. Each patient that enters my surgery is different psychologically. So in order to communicate with them, I have to quickly assess who they are, their personalities, their IQs, the whole thing, so I can communicate with them. And that's what I do with my audiences. I approach each one differently.
You founded the Nuclear Policy Research Institute about 3-4 years ago?
No, 2.5 years ago.
Okay, and how's that going, and what is its goal?
Well, it's hard to raise money, you know, and it really gives me the dry rot when America's spending $500 billion on killing, which is the Pentagon and the corporations. If you spend $1 million a minute since Jesus was born, you would have just about got to $1 trillion. Now, if they just gave me $2 million a year, I could save the Earth. We're really conservative because we're for saving the planet and stopping people killing. However, I have to raise the money from wealthy people and foundations, and so more than half my time goes into fundraising, and that's a waste of time. However, we've had some fantastic symposia. One was the medical implications of depleted uranium weapons, which they're using in Iraq, which is really a nuclear war. That was held at the New York Academy of Medicine a couple of years ago. Then we had one called 3 Minutes to Midnight, the impending threat of nuclear war in Washington a year ago, and I flew out Russians, and we had the very senior people from this country, and that was quite startling, and we had people from both sides, very bipartisan. Then we had one called Nuclear Power and Children's Health in Chicago in October, because Chicago is surrounded by 14 nuclear power plants, all aging, all leaking, and children are very sensitive to the effects of radiation. They get cancer much more readily than adults. That went well. We've got a film from that. If you want to get the film, you can go to our website, nuclearpolicy.org. It's half an hour long. It's quite startling, and at the end, very exciting, because it gives the alternatives to nuclear power. And we've got the proceedings that we're about to publish from that. We've just had a conference called Full Spectrum Dominance, the Weaponization of Space. And that was 2 days. It was a background briefing for 51 of the nation's top journalists. It was at a lovely retreat with the trees and full leaf and the ducks and the swans. It was just fantastic. People from both sides, I mean, hard-bitten physicists, all they could talk about was blinding satellites, blowing nuclear weapons up in space, putting nuclear reactors up there, putting rods from God to hurtle down to the earth to take out cities. I mean, incredibly dreadful, dreadful stuff, and people from the other side. But it was so interesting, because the journalists became personally involved. Instead of sitting back asking sort of cynical questions, they stood up and started talking about how they actually felt. And then the next day, God Almighty, out comes an article by Tim Weiner in the New York Times, and he was going to come to our conference, but he found out the White House is about to issue a report and a plan to put weapons in space. We had a Russian representative there who said, we want to make space totally peaceful, but if you do it, we will. We had a representative from China representing 1.4 billion people. They said the same thing. If you do it, we will too. And someone from Canada to give a Canadian perspective. So it was a pretty startling, powerful conference.
And you, one of your books is The New Nuclear Danger, and you started your talk by saying the Cold War did not end. So
it didn't. All that happened was the Berlin Wall came down. That's all that happened. And the Soviet Union collapsed, and America and Russia made friends, but nothing else has changed. The weapons are all still there on hair trigger alert. It's America that led that motivation to keep the weapons there. So you've got Russia targeted with over 5,000 hydrogen bombs. There are only 240 cities in the Northern Hemisphere. And Russia's got you targeted with 2,500 H-bombs, probably 20, 30 on San Francisco, certainly 40 on New York, according to the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And the Russians nearly blew you up in 1995. They got to within 10 seconds of doing it. Their early warning system is collapsing. They're scared stiff they're going to blow you up by accident, and no one is attending to it.
I think that Boris Yeltsin anecdote is worth telling for a minute.
Yeah, well, what happened was Norway launched a missile with a weather satellite on it near where your 18 Trident submarines, each armed with about 200 hydrogen bombs, roam silently at any time in the seas, targeting Russia. And the Russians picked up this missile going up and said, good God, America's launched a nuclear attack, because your policy still is to fight and win a preemptive secret nuclear war against Russia. I mean, this is pure madness. And Boris Yeltsin, who is drunk, always drunk, for the first time opened the football, which is the nuclear codes. It had never been opened before during the Cold War. He had 3 minutes decision time. His generals were saying, Mr. President, press the button. 10 seconds before the 3 minutes elapsed, 10 seconds, the missile veered off course, and they realized they were not under attack by the U.S., and they closed the football. That was a large article, back page in the New York Times, not front page, 10 seconds from annihilation. That's why we're still here.
And you said President Bush is followed by somebody always with a suitcase containing this football?
If you watch the president closely, there's a man always walking just behind him with a suitcase, which is the football with the nuclear codes. When Ronald Reagan was shot, they lost the football for 2 days. And when Bush met with the ex-pope, or the dead pope now, a few months ago, between their legs, under the table, sat the football to blow up God's creation. And why didn't the pope talk about it to Bush?
Well, why aren't more leaders talking about it, mainstream media talking about it, Americans talking about it? I mean, you listen to your talk, you read your books, and there's such a sense of urgency, not unlike the sense I get at environmental conferences, but
yes,
this is even more definitive.
I'm talking to a lot of senior diplomats now and senior scientists at the labs, and they said to me, this isn't an urgent time, Helen, this is a white-knuckle time. I've got an ex-colonel from Russia who used to be in the missile silos. He's desperate. He keeps calling me all the time. time saying, Helen, we're scared we're going to blow you up by accident. Our early warning systems aren't working. The Chechens could invade our missile silos. You've got to do something. Hold a conference. You know, we've got to talk about this and take the weapons off the missiles so they can't be launched by accident. That's called de-alerting. Do you think I can get the media to attend to this? It's called psychic numbing. And by practicing psychic numbing, we're practicing suicide. And we hospitalize suicidal patients. So the whole world is suicidal. Chirac isn't talking about it. Schroeder isn't talking about it. No one.
Certainly not in this country.
Well, where the hell are their brains, you know? And they're talking about, for God's sake, Michael Jackson. Who gives a flaming flying you-know-what about Michael Jackson?
Survivor.
What on earth are they up
reality
to?
Reality TV and Survivor.
Yeah, but it's displacement activity. If you put rats in a cage and threaten them with a lethal situation, they run away and just do something irrelevant to that which threatens them. That's clinically sick. Or manic denial. We're into gourmet foods, fur coats, you know, you name it. It's a denial that's suicidal. And, you know, we all know subliminally we're threatened with annihilation. So 30% of people are taking antidepressants because they want to wipe that, ablate that feeling. But the way to feel better is to get involved and get active. And then you never take antidepressants again. You meet the most fabulous people and we can fix it.
That's what I was going to ask you. How do we break this denial?
Well, in 5 years, we're going to abolish nuclear weapons between Russia and America. Of the 30,000 bombs in the world, Russia and America own 95%. How dare America be looking at Iran that has no nuclear weapons or pointing to North Korea that maybe has 2 to 5? What does America think it's up to when it owns, you know, 15,000 H-bombs and Russia too? People in glass houses can't throw stones. This is the country that can lead the world towards sanity and survival and rise to its full moral and spiritual heights and do the right thing. And I know the American people want to do that because I led 80% of them in the 80s.
Well, we now have an added frightening, that's an understatement, element with terrorists getting a hold of plutonium.
Yeah, no,
does that worry you?
No, because, you know, they could blow up New York City. I'm talking about the end of life on the planet and turning our planet into a lump of rock like Mars. I mean, as I talk about it, I feel like weeping. What are we talking about, you know, terrorists? We're talking about the real terrorist rogue nations, which are Russia and America with a nuclear standoff holding the world at ransom. How dare they when they're friends? And that's why I called my book in the 80s Missile Envy. It's about a Freudian subliminal reptilian brain psychological dynamic that they like their missiles.
The same one that makes us buy giant SUVs.
Yeah, they compare the missiles to their genitalia.
But what
that's
do you
why
really
I'm
think?
Going to write a book called Why Men Kill. And I mean, they've got to stop killing. I'm fed up. In every square in Europe, there's a man on a horse who's a killer. We pedestalize killers throughout society, and we have always done so since we lived in caves. We needed men to kill then, 3 million years ago, to save our lives. Now, if they keep killing, they're going to blow up the planet. So I'm going to look at it from a sociobiological perspective, a neurophysiological, a Jungian archetypal perspective. Try and analyze it. And I know it's potent because some men get terribly upset when I talk about it, and the women leap to their defense. So we need to open up the debate.
Okay, we're going to continue this discussion with Dr. Helen Caldicott right after these messages. You're listening to Eco Talk on Air America Radio.
So much, how much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? A little pollution is so thick and dark and dense, it contaminates and poisons common good and common sense.
And those words always ring true. Political pollution seems to damage our common sense thinking, whatever. He said it better. But political pollution is so thick and dark and dense, it contaminates our thinking and our common sense. You say our planet is in intensive care and we're asleep at the wheel.
Yeah. When I wrote my book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, as a physician, I always prognosticate. I gather all the data about the patient, all the tests and the physical examination, then I make a prognosis. I will be lucky to survive the next 20 years, if not the next 10, with these people in charge in the White House. Never in my 66 years of life have I ever seen a more dangerous, wicked administration than this one. And they're hurtling towards nuclear annihilation, almost overtly, consciously doing it. Say, we'll drop nuclear weapons on anyone we so desire. I mean, the arrogance and the wickedness is unsurpassed.
Not that if John Kerry had gotten to the White House, it would have, you know, reduced in
John
a significant
Kerry,
way the
John
the damage,
Kerry has been on my board of Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament for 20 years. I taught John about this stuff.
Oh.
And if he'd been elected, I would have had open access to him in the White House.
But I guess what I'm saying is, how much power do we have over the other nations that are a threat?
No, you only have power over yourself, but you're the model for the rest of the world. If you, with Russia, and Russia's ready, work in the next 5 years to abolish your nuclear weapons, France, China and England have said they will do the same thing. Israel's difficult. She's a rogue state. She's got up to 400 hydrogen bombs, the third largest nuclear power in the world. She has not signed the NPT, non-proliferation treaty. She would have to have her arm twisted behind her back, but you could do that because she supplies a lot of money for her weapons. And then Pakistan and India would have to be pressured too, but they're fairly easy. And then you have a moral leg to stand on. Then you can say to other nations, we've done the right thing, but as you keep making more bombs, up to 400 new ones a year you're into now, and as you maintain an arsenal on hair trigger alert to blow up the planet, you have not a moral standing at all in the world. And the rest of the world sort of laughing at you and saying, well, you know, if you do, we will too. So you have to do the right thing, and I know most Americans really want to. 75% of Americans in the latest poll support nuclear disarmament. I don't think most of them know that you've got all these weapons ready to go with the press of the button. And George W. Bush has 3 minutes decision time, and he, you know, if he's woken up at 3 a.m. from a REM 4 sleep, what decision is he going to make? It's pretty scary.
One can only think of that book about the goats during the moments after 9/11. The U.S. needs some tough love.
Yeah, well, you know, the U.S. is like an alcoholic father, and if you really love your father, you say, Dad, I'm taking you to the Betsy Ford Clinic, and you're going to dry out and get better.
Betty this Ford Clinic.
What did I say?
Betsy Ford.
Again, I'm sorry.
I haven't been there yet, but
no,
I'm
no.
headed there. If I keep up this beat, drive me to drink.
The Betty Ford Clinic, or a similar clinic. And you see, the whole world, and that's 96% of the world's population, stands by allowing this country to be so arrogant. It's the most heavily armed nation in the world with weapons of mass destruction. It says it's the world's policeman. We don't want to be policed. It's going to dominate space with weapons in space. How dare it? Space is a global commons. And it's addicted to violence and superiority. And that's not right. I mean, just think of FDR. He wouldn't behave like that. Jack Kennedy wouldn't have behaved like that. I think patriotism and nationalism is obsolete. We're the family of nations. We work together with humility. So why doesn't Chirac and Schroeder and all the rest of them gather around to say, okay, America, stop it. You've got to stop it, and that's tough love. We like you, but you've got to stop this.
But there's now talk about building new nuclear power plants to combat global warming.
Well, that's because Cheney is scientifically illiterate. He doesn't understand the medical implications of nuclear power, and that's really wicked. I mean, because nuclear power is a cancer industry. It produces massive quantities of long-lived radioactive isotopes, which bioconcentrate in the food chain thousands of times at each step. Algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish, humans, milk. And these isotopes go to various organs, thyroid, lung, liver, spleen, bone, and cause all sorts of cancers for the rest of time.
We don't know what to do with the waste yet, and human beings are not infallible.
You will find out what to do with waste. How arrogant it is of us to say we can store radioactive waste safely for 500,000 years. A scientist develops a hypothesis which he or she proves or disproves within their lifetime. We'll be dead soon, and we leave this legacy of cancer for all future generations, which will produce epidemics, and I kid you not, of cancer, particularly in children who are so radiosensitive. Genetic disease, my specialty, is the commonest fatal genetic disease of childhood, cystic fibrosis. 1 in 25 Caucasians carry that gene. There are 3,000 such diseases. Radiation increases the incidence of genetic disease. And remember, we're not the only species with genes. all the 30,000 other species have genes and they get cancer and genetic disease too. So what we're doing with nuclear power is hideous in terms of evolution and global public health. We spend millions trying to cure cancer. We nearly kill you trying to cure your cancers, and you almost always die of the cancer. Yet here we have an industry actively promoting huge numbers of cancers for the rest of time.
One of the most chilling things I heard you say when I heard you speak last night is, I don't think my grandchildren have a future.
No, at the moment they don't.
I have a 10-year-old daughter who's always talking about how she's going to grow up and have four children because she's an only child. And
yeah.
I went home last night, kissed her goodnight, and cried. I mean, after hearing your talk.
I know.
Gosh,
I've got five grandchildren.
That's pretty compelling. That's pretty compelling stuff. So, but people are reacting to this or not reacting
to
this? Well, you did. I did, yes. But
so you're probably typical of all mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a pediatrician, and potentially all the world's children are my patients. I took the Hippocratic Oath, and I'm damned. Over my dead body, do we kill them? So we've got 5 years to produce bilateral nuclear disarmament with Russia and close down the 103 reactors in this country. And don't you dare let Cheney and the nuclear industry, including GE, build any more.
In 30 seconds, what can people do if they're concerned about
this
conversation?
You can go read my book, The New Nuclear Danger. You can go to the website, nuclearpolicy.org. You can get films from our website, books and the like. Educate yourselves. Show the films to your churches. Get your churches involved. This is the ultimate moral and religious issue of our time, whether or not God's creation continues.
We need to take our heads out of the sand.
We do.
And you can go to our blog site, ecotalkblog.com, for more information about today's guests and links to their resources. Thanks for joining us. Have a great green week.
How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much and how much longer?